That was Bull, was the name I was trying to think of. He was our G3 and my direct superior in Algiers. Well, anyway, there were 14 officers selected to go up and join the new staff in London, which was to be known as SHAFE, Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force. I was one of the 14 chosen. And when you consider that there were several hundred officers on the staff, you can recognize that this was something of an honor so far as I was concerned. Well, I was not enough senior to be eligible for a VIP flight, so I was assigned a berth on a Belgian ship, which had formerly been a cross-channel ferry from Antwerp to London. Well, it wasn't too bad. It was not a big ship, but it was fairly comfortable. And the people on it were great, mostly British. I became very well acquainted with a British baronet, Sir Richard White, who at that time was a major in the British Army, and we became very good friends and had a lot of fun on board the ship. Well, we arrived in Greenock, Scotland, and of course I had never been in the British Isles, knew nothing about it. Well, we arrived in Greenock, and Dick said, well now, where are you going? I said, well, I have to go to London. I've been ordered in there. He said, well, come on, let's go to London, and I'll introduce you to the hotel that I like there very much. So we caught the train and went down to London. He took me over to his hotel, which was the Sloane's Court. And I have tried to find it since when I've been back in London, but without success. But it was a very comfortable hotel. And as I recall, very reasonably priced. Probably something like $5 or $6 a night. Well, I checked into the headquarters, what was in St. James Square, and was assigned a billet in a house up on Wimpole Street. Well, now, if you'll remember your British, pardon me, English literature, you'll know that Elizabeth Barrett Browning lived up on Wimpole Street. In fact, there was a book written, The Barretts of Wimpole Street. Well, I believe they were at number 47. I was at either 27 or 29, I don't remember which. It was very comfortable, and I was busier than a cat trying to cover up on a tin roof. But they didn't know what to do with me, so they put me in charge of the war room. Well, the war room is where we were developing the maps to show what the invasion was to be in France several months hence. Well, the war room, of course, was super secret, and nobody was allowed into it unless they were specifically cleared. And I had a little bit of trouble with some of the officers that wanted to come in and look at the map, because I couldn't let them in. We always had two MPs on the door. Well, then the war room also became the favorite place for Ike to hold some of his high-level conferences. And I can remember a number of these. One in particular, where Montgomery and Air Chief Marshal Tedder and General Bradley and I don't know who all else, they were arguing about how the aircraft were going to be employed in support of the invasion. Well, Tedder kept arguing and arguing and arguing, and finally our turned to him and he said, "Listen here, I have made up my mind, I have made the decision, it's going to stand. I don't want to hear any more about it." He didn't. Well, we were stationed in London now. This was at Norfolk House in London. And one night we had quite a bombing raid. In fact, they called it the Little Blitz. It wasn't really as much of a raid as the Blitz had been a couple of years before. But it was a humdinger. Several hundred German planes overhead, all kinds of bombardment, and a great many firebombs dropped. Well, the firebombs were aluminum about, let's say they were 30 inches long and about 2 inches in diameter. And they had most of them had a delayed fuse, so that when they hit, they didn't burst into flame immediately, but they would delay a few minutes, a few seconds actually, probably 20 or 30 seconds. Well, as usual, I was being my foolhardy self. I was up on the roof of our house watching the raid. And it was a humdinger. It was a good raid. And all of a sudden, right across the street from us, I noticed that there was a blaze coming up in the attic of the house there. And it was really beginning to burn. Apparently, one of these firebombs had come through the roof into the attic and then had set fire. Well, this firebomb was a little different from some of the others. I went over to see if I could help and grabbed a fire extinguisher, went in where the fire was and was playing the extinguisher in there when all of a sudden the damn bomb blew up. It had a delayed action explosive in it. That's where I got my Purple Heart, incidentally. Well, the streets of London at that time were paved a great deal in wooden blocks. These were creosoted blocks, creosote-soaked blocks. But when these firebombs hit, they just stuck in the wood. And actually, it looked like a porcupine. It was the damnedest thing the following morning to see firebombs all over the place that had not gone off and sticking in the street. A very strange sight. Oh, I didn't tell you about the other air raid I was in. This was in Algiers before I left to go to London. Well, in Algiers, I didn't have any transportation, and the motor pool didn't give a major a car very often. So I wangled a motorcycle from the French. Got a brand new Harley-Davidson motorcycle. And every night when I got back to my house where I was billeted, I parked the motorcycle out in front. Well, this particular night, we heard the sirens. And of course, you hear the sirens, everybody goes outside to see what's going on. And the searchlights are playing around and the airplanes are flying over and the guns are going off. And all of a sudden, right in front of me, between me and my motorcycle, a 20 millimeter shell landed and exploded. The only damage I got was a little nick in the arm of my leather jacket. But the motorcycle, it had had it. So I called the MPs the next day and I said, my motorcycle got caught in the raid last night and got a little damage. If you'll trade me for one that's running, I'll let you have this. It's a brand spanking new one. All you got to do is put some new oil lines and stuff in it. He said, "Major, you got a deal." So I got another motorcycle that I rode around in for a long time. Okay, well, back to London. After this air raid in London, they decided that we'd better get the hell out of town. And we moved up to a place called Bushy Park, which actually was just outside Hampton Court Palace. Well, Hampton Court Palace was the favorite palace of Henry VIII, and he had very elaborate landscaping, and it was a beautiful part. And there we were housed in kind of makeshift huts, but rather comfortable. And I was still in the war room, but it didn't last long because we were then approaching D-Day, and I was required to go down to Portsmouth and see about some things down there and tie up a few loose ends. And so I was taken out of the war room, put into plans and training. Well, this was a routine office job with quite a bit of paper shuffling, of course. And we had some very interesting episodes. We had to build slit trenches. They dug slit trenches all over the garden. And whenever there was an air raid, we were supposed to leave our desk, everything exactly as it was, get out, dive into a slit trench. Well, this really wasn't such a good idea because you were always working with classified material, and if you left the classified material out on your desk, anybody could come in and read it. So we had a little bit of a problem there. We finally devised a method whereby we put all the classified material into one basket, threw it in the safe, and locked the safe. Well, this was about the time, again, shortly before D-Day, that the V-1s and V-2s started coming. Well, as you know, the V-1s were rockets, and they were launched from the Belgian coast around Peenemunde. And they were supersonic. You never heard them coming. You never heard a thing until they exploded. And then when they exploded, you heard the sonic boom that they created as they were coming to you. My closest experience to one of those was when I was in London overnight at Marble Arch, and one fell not far from the hotel. It was quite an experience. Well, the V-2s were another. They were quite different. These were nothing but bombs with a wing on them and a jet-type engine. And these would fly along, not too fast, about 200 miles an hour, until the engine ran out of fuel, and they just stalled and went in and crashed and exploded. Well, we had a lot of them. Oh, they came over, and we'd run out the slit trench, but we'd hear it coming. It sounded like a washing machine engine. Put, 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 put. And here it would come. We could see it coming. Then it would cut off. Then everybody held their breath to see where it was going to land. Well, again, they were very inaccurate and didn't do a whole hell of a lot of damage. They were morale busters more than anything else because they did make you stop whatever you were doing and go out and become involved in protecting yourself or whatever it was. Well, along came D-Day, and as you know, that was June 6th, 1944. I had to be in Portsmouth 2 days before D-Day. And I was present at the last minute briefing for the Supreme Commander and the very top brass. And the weather had not been good, as you know. And even the night before they went, the weather was still pretty bad. But Ike said, we're going. So we did. Well, I was not part of D-Day. But it wasn't very long later, about 5 weeks later, a group of us were sent over to what they called Chafe Forward, which was to be the advance headquarters for the for Chafe. And we set up in a little town, I can't even think of the name of it now, in northwestern France. Not far, incidentally, from Mont-Saint-Michel. Avranches, that was the name of the town. Avranches, A-V-R-A-N-C-H-E-S. Well, this was a very, shall we say, primitive type thing. Open-air latrines, tents, not much in the way of comfort. One day, one of the supply trucks had come into the headquarters, to the mess, to deliver some rations. And as it was heading out, it drove over the same area that it used coming in. It hit a buried mine. That blew the wheel off the truck and damaged the truck pretty bad. Wounded the driver and scared the hell out of the boys that were riding in the back and the assistant driver. But really didn't do much damage, but a little crater in the ground about 3 feet across and 1.5 feet deep. But that caused quite a bit of excitement, as you can imagine. Well, we weren't there very long. I said it was about 5 weeks after D-Day. It must have been longer than that. It must have been toward the end of July. Because Paris was liberated on the 22nd of August. And I went into Paris the very next day because we had been told that we were going to have to be ready to move on a moment's notice. And as soon as Paris was liberated, those of us in the planning and operations were to go directly to Paris and get ourselves involved in the plans for the balance of the war. Well, we were put up, our office became, headquarters became the, well, come on, brain. Oh, the hotel in Versailles. I know it, I can see it. Can't think of the name of it right now. But we were put up in the hotel in Versailles. And actually, it was a very comfortable situation. And my office was in what had been the stable area. Very comfortable office. Ike and all the senior officers were in the hotel itself. But every time we had to see any of them, we'd have to go over to the main hotel. Well, here comes Mary and Eloise, so I'll knock it off for the time being. Okay, here we are back several days later after Mary got married and a lot of other things happened. The hotel that I was trying to think of was the Trianon Palace in Versailles. You may have seen pictures of it in various advertisements and one thing and another. It was a very famous hotel, and one just across the street from the magnificent palace in Versailles. When Lucille and I went to Europe in 1970, we had the opportunity to go out and have lunch at the hotel. And believe it or not, one of the old concierge was there and remembered me, and we had quite a chat about the war and about how things went and one thing or another like that. One thing I forgot to mention when I was talking about Tunisia, you'll recall that I mentioned that we had run into an old college friend of mine with the 9th Division. Well, that was the trip when we went up, and of course we had to report to all of the headquarters. For example, I was with AFHQ, Allied Forces in Africa, but the Corps headquarters, which was commanded by Patton at that time, was of course subordinate to AFHQ. And I had to report into Patton's office to be sure that he knew that I was in his area. Well, the Chief of Staff, General Jeff Keyes, I talked to him and explained why we were there and where we were going. He said, "That's fine, we're glad to have you. Well, should I report to General Patton direct?" And Keyes said, "Well, I don't think that's necessary." So we started to leave the office. But we had to walk past Patton's door, which was open. I should backtrack here again for a moment and say that when Patton took command of the Corps, he ordered that all of the personnel in the Corps would wear combat boots at all times, carry their sidearms at all times, and also wear a helmet. Well, I was in headquarters dress. I had low quarter shoes on. I did have a sidearm, but I had a soft cap instead of a helmet. So as I walked past the door, Patton happened to look up. "Well," he said, "Griffith, what do you mean coming into my area looking like that?" And I said, "Well, General, I'm dreadfully sorry that we don't comply, but I left Algiers before we got the word that you had ordered the combat apparel to be worn at all times." Well, Patton sort of went, "Oof," and said, "Okay, go on." So we went on with our trip up to Gafsa and McNassee. Well, now let's get back to Paris and Versailles. Well, while we were in Versailles, I had the job handed to me of preparing a very complicated staff study. A staff study is what the personnel on the commander's staff prepare for the commander's consideration and to help him make his decisions. Well, my staff study was to be on the utilization of recovered manpower, the people who had been overrun by the Germans, the Poles, the French, every nationality you can think of that had been herded into camps, not extermination camps like they did with the Jews, but into sort of like prisoner of war camps where they just moldered and did nothing creative. Well, it was a very complicated staff study and required a great deal of work. It took about, 6 or 7 weeks, I think, to complete. And when it was complete, the study as a whole was about 1/2 to 3/4 of an inch thick. Now you can imagine how many pages there were in something like that. Well, the cover letter was to be signed by Ike and sent to the Combined Chiefs of Staff in Washington. Well, it required, one thing that was essential was that when the letter was typed, it could not have any kind of an error. No typographical error, no strike over, no erasures. And this was in the day before electric typewriters, mind you. The girl that had to type it, her name today is Agnes Hepler because she married one of the boys in the headquarters at that time. But Agnes worked and worked and worked, and she finally, the letter was about a page and a quarter, page and a half maybe, and I don't know how many times she typed it over, but when she finally got it in perfect condition, we put the whole staff study together and sent it up to Beadle Smith, the chief of staff, General Eisenhower's chief of staff. Well, Beadle thought that it was pretty good. He really did. And he complimented my boss highly on the way that we had prepared the staff study. Well, one of the interesting things that occurred out of this, two other majors worked with me very closely on it, a Major Brown and a Major Lucky. They were both regular Army officers out of West Point. Well, when we got all through, both of them were awarded a medal for what they had done. But for me, as a reserve officer, I was just promoted, which fortunately turned out to be one of the best things that ever happened to me. The medal didn't mean a thing. It was merely another acknowledgement of the fact that you'd worked on Eisenhower's staff and didn't really amount to anything. But the promotion was much better. I then became a lieutenant colonel. Well, about this time, things started to slack off. We were getting well into Germany, and, well, not into Germany exactly, but close to the German border, and we had practically cleaned up the war. Now, this was November, early December, 1944. Well, Christmas Eve, 1944, I was appointed as the staff duty officer for SHAEF, which meant that I had to be up in the chief of staff's office and spend the night up there. Well, that wasn't too bad a job. Everybody had to do it at one time or another. I just happened to catch it the day that the Battle of the Bulge started. And that was really an exciting night. The phone never stopped ringing. Of course, we got the reports from the Ardennes Forest that the Germans had launched this attack, and we got the reports from General McAuliffe that he didn't think he could hang on, but he was going to try. And then about, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, we had a call from Patton's headquarters. And Patton's headquarters said, now this is not General Patton himself, this is the staff. And they said, do you feel that we should change our direction of attack and move up to the Ardennes to support the troops that are in trouble up there? Well, I can't make a decision like that. I have to contact a lot of very high-priced, high-ranking generals to do it. Well, anyway, the outcome was that Patton's Third Army would move up and would help support and, of course, eventually turn back. Well, General Simpson's Ninth Army was up there, too, and they were having a terrible time disengaging from where they were being pushed forward and getting back to where they could do something about the Battle of the Bulge. But as you know, the Battle of the Bulge lasted a couple of weeks, almost 3 weeks, and then it ended with success on our part and the defeat of the Germans. I'm not sure that I told in the early part of this tape about my experience at SHAEF headquarters shortly after I joined them in London. I was working on plans at that time and had to appear at a number of conferences and briefings and one kind or another like that. And I was a little late arriving at one of them. And the room was quite full. people, well, actually there were very few seats left, but I noticed down in the front row were two bald-headed officers sitting there. So in a rather jaunty voice I said, "Well, I guess I'll go join the bald-headed row." I walked down. One of the bald heads was my friend General Simpson, who I mentioned a few moments ago as commanding 9th Army, and the other, nobody less than Ike himself. Well, if the floor had opened up and swallowed me, I would have felt very much better. But anyway, I have no idea today what the conference was about. But anyway, I sat down in the front row with the bald heads. Well, now let's leave Versailles. Came the late winter of 1944-45, and they needed a member from the Chafe staff to join the French Rearmament Committee. Now, I had worked very closely with the French in North Africa and spoke pretty good French at that time, so I went over to the well, actually, it was more than a French Rearmament Committee. It was a big liaison job working with the French Army. And incidentally, the head of the committee was General Kingman, who had been deputy commander of the 2nd Armored Division at the time of the invasion of North Africa. And, of course, I knew him quite well. Well, I enjoyed a very, what do we say, luxurious lifestyle. I was billeted in the Hotel Meurice, which is one of the very finest hotels in Paris, a small hotel, but today the rooms go for about, $250, $275 a night. I had a very nice room. I overlooked the Tuileries Garden, right next to the Louvre Museum, and well, it was a real plush assignment, and one that I enjoyed very, very much. I'm wondering now just how much to tell you about this next episode. Before I left Versailles, I had met a French family that we became very close friends. And I would go over to their home for supper every once in a while. Perhaps I'd meet them on a Sunday afternoon, and we'd have a very pleasant time together. Well, they had a daughter who was about 20, and she and I went out to a number of events. We'd go to the opera, or we'd go to a concert, but nothing of any seriousness at all. In fact, she was not my idea of a very lovely woman, anything but. But we had very pleasant times together. We enjoyed ourselves. When we'd go to a concert, we could compare notes. When we went to the opera, we could compare our opinions of the opera and the voices and one thing or another like that. It was very, very nice. Well, I'm sorry about getting so hoarse, but I seem to be having trouble with my throat. Well, anyway, we got to the point that, well, we'd see each other every 2 or 3 weeks, possibly. Well, one day when I was in the office, I was told that I had a visitor. Well, our office was pretty secure. We weren't allowed to have very many visitors. In fact, very few people knew just exactly where we were or what we were doing. But it was Papa Clément, the girl's father. And he was dressed to the nines. Oh, he was sartorially perfectly turned out. We sat down, he started to talk, and we chatted a little bit. And finally he said, "Well, Colonel, What are your intentions toward my daughter? Well, that kind of turned me back a little bit. I didn't quite know what to say to him, except to assure him that our friendship was purely platonic, that it was nothing else other than the fact that we enjoyed doing things together and were able to do them together. Well, he was pleased with that and went about his way. Well, then came VE Day, Victory in Europe, early in May. Well, I had kept track of the 2nd Armored Division fairly well. I knew where it was at all times, but I had not kept track of the people in it. So the evening before the surrender was signed up in Reims, a very old dear friend of mine from the 2nd Armored Division turned up in Paris. He had been home on leave. He'd had enough time built up that they gave him what they called an R&R back to the States. That's rest and recuperation. Well, there was nothing to do, but we had to do Paris nightlife. And he said he had to get back up to the division the next day. So I said, okay, I'll try and arrange it. And I arranged an airplane that could fly us back up to where the 2nd Armored Division was bivouacked at that time. Well, Shorty Parker and I really did Paris that night. Finally, about 1 o'clock in the morning, I gave up. I had to get back and get to bed. He rolled in about 3:30 or 4, and I had the plane all laid down for 8 o'clock in the morning. Well, it was a little difficult to get him up, but I finally did get him out of bed, and we poured ourselves into a staff car and drove out to the airport, climbed into the plane, and flew up to where the 2nd Armored Division was. Well, that was old home week. All kinds of people that I had not seen since I left the division in North Africa. It was a wonderful, well, it was a grand day. We had a wonderful time seeing people, talking over everything, and finding out just what kind of honors the division had earned. And they had earned a great many very fine commendations and had been extremely successful. I think I told you that the distant cousin who took over the battalion when I left was killed in France. Actually, he didn't have to die. He was shot in the groin, but he just gave up entirely when he learned that he had been emasculated completely and didn't even try to get well. The doctors told me later that had he just had a little more willpower, he well could have survived the wound, which was not a fatal wound. Okay, the war is over now. And Schaeff becomes, well, it's still Schaeff, but they call it, well, Supreme Headquarters Allied Forces Europe. And, yeah, instead of Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Forces. So I was at loose ends, and about this time I ran into an old friend of mine, a colonel, who was setting up part of the staff at the headquarters, which was to be in Frankfurt, Germany. Well, he asked me if I wouldn't join him, so I did. I went up there and I became head of the morale branch of G1. Now, perhaps I've not explained to you the way a general staff is divided. It's G1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. G1 handles all of the personnel activities. G2 handles all of the intelligence activities. G3 is operations, plans, organization, and training. and G4 is supply. G5 is the civil end of it and has to take care of the activities vis-a-vis the Germans at that time. Well, I was head of the morale branch of G1, which covered a whole lot of different activities. For example, I supervised the exchange service, and I had to do with the awarding of medals, all kinds of things. You name it, and I was probably had something to do with it, if it had anything to do with the personnel. Well, this was a very rewarding experience. I enjoyed it. I had a very fine time, had some fine officers assigned to me. Then later, I just changed offices, actually, and had two officers assigned to me who became very, very famous in their own right later. Both were majors at the time. One was a Major Sam Phillips, who ended up as a four-star general in charge of all of the Minuteman program, the intercontinental ballistic missiles. The other was a Major McDermott, who ended up as head of the United Services Automobile Association and built it from a very small insurance activity into a huge multi-force activity, the biggest employer, actually, in San Antonio, Texas. That was quite an experience. Well, this was, well, let's see, this came about, when was it? Late in the summer of 1945. Well, I had applied for Lucille and the children to come and join me in Germany, and I had enough points that they would be among the very first group to come over. Unfortunately, they were out on the West Coast, and it was difficult for them to arrange things. So when they got their announcement that they were eligible to go and could go in the very first ship, Lucille had to ask to be delayed because she couldn't possibly arrange her things in time to catch that first ship. So they came over on a later ship. I think they got there actually, as I recall, in late 1945. I can't remember. Isn't that awful? I can't remember the exact time, but it was in the fall. We were assigned quarters in Frankfurt at an address that I remember very well, 27 Stettinstrasse. We were next door to another very good friend of mine, Lieutenant Colonel, and across the street from another guy that we came to know very well, Lieutenant Colonel Brown, whose son, incidentally, dated Joyce quite a bit, and they ran around together they were both pretty young, but they still did things together for quite a while. One night we were sitting in the Browns' living room, mixing up pousse-cafés. That is the layered drink that you make with various liqueurs, that each layer is a different color. We were just having a ball, and all of a sudden, the front door opened, and in walks a military policeman. Well, Betty Brown looked up and with very severe voice said, "I don't believe you knocked." Well, it seemed that the military policeman had been informed that there was a rape going on in the neighborhood and thought possibly our address where we were was where it was. Well, it turned out to be next door. Well, that pretty much put a quietus on the Puscafes, but we had a very pleasant evening anyway. Oh, there's so many things to talk about in Frankfurt. I really need somebody to remind me from time to time. That was where nobody had an automobile. And of course, I was not senior enough to be entitled to use a staff car whenever I wanted. Well, once in a while I could arrange that I could get a staff car. But after Lucille and the kids arrived, they had a sale back in France at one of the big ordnance depots there of Jeeps. And the prices of the Jeeps ran from $125 to $250. So I ordered a $125 Jeep and was awarded it. Well, then, of course, I had to get to France and get to this depot where the Jeep was stored. I got there. I don't remember how, but I got there. And they turned over to me a rather decrepit-looking Jeep, but one that ran, the engine sounded great. So I climbed aboard and filled it up with gasoline and headed back for Frankfurt. Well, I'd gone about, 50 or 75 miles when there was a terrible odor of burning rubber. Well, what had happened was that the emergency brake on it had been bent, and the fiber on the brake itself had rubbed against the brake drum. And boy, did it stink. Well, I managed to stop, and no real harm done, except that I didn't have an emergency brake anymore. Got back to Frankfurt. Well, that Jeep, we had to disguise the fact that it was military, so I painted half of the hood red and half of the hood blue, covering up all of the military numbers. I don't recall what I painted the bumpers, but I had to paint the bumpers to cover up the military numbers on them, too. Well, Lucille drove that Jeep all over Frankfurt, and we have pictures of her and Warren, Joyce, and Sarah in the Jeep with Danny, our great, huge dog. And, well, anyway, the Jeep finally had to be painted. So I arranged to trade a carton of cigarettes to a German to paint it. Well, about this same time, I learned about a man who was making tops for these Jeeps. And I arranged to have the seats upholstered and a wooden and glass top built for it. As I recall, that cost me two cartons of cigarettes and a couple of pounds of coffee and a box of Hershey bars. Well, we drove that Jeep all over Europe. We drove it to France and then took the tour into Switzerland, came back to France, drove it back to Frankfurt. About this time, the exchange service arranged to buy 100 cars from various automakers, and they were to be sold on a lottery basis. You'd put your name in, and they drew your name, or they drew the cards out of the pot, and if you were fortunate, if your name was drawn, why, you were allowed to purchase a car. Well, they drew 99 names, and guess whose was the 100th? Mine. And we got...